When your company earns unlimited 2% cash back on all purchases with Capital One, that's serious business. So, Steven at SandCloud got a serious business card, the Spark Cash Plus card from Capital One.
We used our 2% cash back to help build our retail presence.
Savvy, Steven.
And we get big purchasing power, so our business can spend more and earn more.
The Spark Cash Plus card from Capital One. What's in your wallet?
Terms and conditions apply. Find out more at CapitalOne.com/SparkCashPlus.
Welcome back to The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. I am Sonny Bunch, culture editor at The Bulwark. I'm very pleased to be joined again by Ryan Fonder. Thank you for being back on the show, Ryan. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Sonny.
Ryan is film business reporter for the Los Angeles Times' Company Town and the host of the entertainment business newsletter, The Wide Shot. If you haven't signed up for The Wide Shot after the last time he was on the show, go do it now. It's great. We're going to be talking about a couple of his newsletters here. So, you know, if you had been reading up as I told you to, you'll be well versed in some of this. But go check it out. Fonder writes about Hollywood studios, including Walt Disney Company, and has covered such major stories as the Sony hack. Thank you again for being on the show. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me back.
So the reason I wanted to have you on today was because one of your most recent newsletter really caught my eye, because it's something I've been thinking about a lot recently. You were writing about the proliferation of gambling ads in sports.
Yes.
And this jumps out at me for two reasons. One, I recently read a very interesting book about the rise of daily fantasy called Billion Dollar Fantasy. And there's a whole section in that book where they talk about just how crazy the ad spends got. If you remember, like, 4 or 5 years back, every football game, every single ad was for either FanDuel or DraftKings or one of those. But secondly, because it's an under-discussed aspect of the business of entertainment right now, that sports are really the only live TV thing that still work. It's like the only network and like mainstream cable thing that still works from an advertising perspective, right?
Yeah, I mean, you're hitting the nail right on the head when you talk about live sports being sort of the bulwark, pun intended, for live TV right now. Because I mean, it used to be that, and also award season, right? Like the Emmys, the Oscars, those would be some of the biggest things on TV, and those are just hitting all-time lows. I think the Emmys had sort of a dead cat bounce effect where they came up a little bit in the most recent one. But yeah, you look at the NFL, the beginning season of the NFL, the first few weeks are up like somewhere around 17% in total viewers for the season over last year, which is, you don't really see anything like that in TV right now. And that's why you have so many of these big companies spending billions and billions of dollars for NFL rights. Like if you win the NFL, you win basically the whole thing. And, you know, Amazon's getting in the mix too, spending, I think, somewhere around $11 billion just for Thursday night football rights. I mean, that's not a highly watched part of the NFL lineup Thursday night, but they're still willing to go pretty far into this business just for those games, in a way that's sort of incongruous with the rest of Amazon's offering. I don't know if you ever, I don't often go on to Amazon to watch live sports, but when you do, it's interesting because Amazon does not have an ad-based model. So when you watch Thursday Night Football on Amazon, there's a lot of ads, like all the ad space that would be for, you know, products and things like that, or movie trailers, they're all for other Amazon shows or just the NFL network. It's quite strange experience.
Yeah, well, that's really interesting. I wanted to ask you about that because I have not watched any of the like Thursday night exclusive things on Amazon, and part of me wonders whether it makes any sense for the streamers to get into bidding wars for these network or for these sporting leagues, because the only reason that, you know, ESPN or ABC or Fox or NBC will pony up the billions is because they can then sell even more billions in ad revenue and in ad inventory. But if you're on Amazon where they don't do ads, if you're on Netflix where they don't do ads, what's the point of getting these networks?
Yeah, I mean, with Amazon, the point is attention, just getting more share of eyeballs. We've talked about this before, that they're really competing, just like Netflix is, in the attention economy. Netflix is getting into video games and interactive content for exactly this reason, right? They just want, you know, more share of your waking hours to be spent on Netflix. Amazon's doing the same thing. They're doing it in a slightly different way with sports. But yeah, you're right in that I don't think Netflix has really gotten into this bidding war yet, because they really are not an ad-based business at all. And you see this dynamic play out too with Disney and their ESPN Plus product, which, if you ever spend any time on ESPN Plus, it's a little bit of an interesting experience, because there's a lot of archival stuff. There's a lot of supplemental material on ESPN Plus, but there's not a whole lot of live game coverage of the major sports leagues. And that's partly because, you know, I would imagine that ESPN and Disney don't want to take too much attention away from the actual ESPN network, which is where all the ad dollars is going.
Well, and ESPN Plus also has an exclusive deal with UFC that's very profitable, right? I mean, that's a huge moneymaker for them.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. UFC is massive for ESPN in general, and ESPN Plus as well. And that sort of gets to one of the points that we were trying to make in the recent newsletter, when we were talking about sports gambling. And there's this sort of disconnect, you know, in the past. I think even 2 years ago, Bob Iger was on a earnings call, and he was asked about whether ESPN would get into sports betting in a real way. And he essentially said, no, I don't really see us getting involved in there. You'll see us do some content around sports betting. But, you know, we don't really see ourselves getting into that business in a direct way. Flash forward 2 years later, and Bob Chapek is on a similar conference call saying, basically, our bands are into sports betting. The leagues are interested in sports betting, so we're into sports betting. And so There's this idea of Disney as this family-friendly brand that doesn't want to sully itself with these sort of gray area things like sports betting. UFC, you know, pretty violent sport, kind of breaks that mold a little bit in the first place, I would think, in terms of the family-friendly stuff. But yeah, they definitely seem more comfortable getting involved in it. And it's because you have young people who are interested in this, and you know, that's where the viewers are at. They're trying to get young people more engaged.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the actual ads here, because this is interesting. I mean, in England and in Great Britain, there was a push to get these ads that were, you know, playing in your newsletter, it said in a four ad pod, three of them would be for daily fantasy or some other sort of sports gambling,
right?
You know, actual sports books, which, you know, operate a little more freely in Great Britain than here. What was that all about? I mean, and is there any likelihood that a similar push to regulate this sort of stuff more heavily could come to the United States?
Well, it's interesting that anecdote that you're talking about came from the NFL's chief strategy and growth officer. That was like, he was making an observation of what he saw when going to London several years ago, when people really were inundated with gambling ads, and it became such a problem that the UK sports books actually voluntarily agreed to what's called a whistle-to-whistle ban on sports betting, where they wouldn't advertise during the actual sports broadcasts themselves. The NFL and the media companies in the US would like to avoid a similar situation. So the NFL is basically doing a lot of self-regulating, saying you can only have one ad per quarter in a football game. And also you can have two other ads, but they're in pregame and halftime. So it's really six ads per broadcast. Local stations can do whatever they want, you know, in the morning or evening, but and the NFL is quite conscious of this. And when you talk to people at, say, Fox Sports or ESPN, any of the major sports broadcasters, they're also really cognizant of not wanting to go too far, even though this is a massive windfall for them if they can get these ad dollars.
Yeah, I mean, I like what was the number that I forget, was it FanDuel or DraftKings? They said they had spent almost $1 billion already this year.
To date, like, yeah, yeah. I think it was Amy Howe, the new CEO of FanDuel, who's talking on CNBC, basically making the argument that sports betting in the U.S. was hitting bubble territory because of all the ad spend that's going on. I mean, these companies are not profitable yet. They're spending the vast majority of their revenue on ad space, and they're just desperate for market share. And you know, they're expecting some kind of consolidation to come to result from everything shaking out. And so they're hoping that, you know, if they just spend enough money and get enough attention, they'll be one of the ones left standing when the bubble kind of crashes.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's all about customer acquisition at this point still, which is, I mean, crazy. Like I said, this really interesting book that I read, it was the same thing, you know, 5 years ago when these companies were first coming around. It was all about, you know, what is the estimated revenue per user, right? The ARPU, right? And what is that going to look like for these customers as it goes along? And they're like, it's enormous. The amount of money that we can get from one person that we acquire to the site is enormous. So we're going to spend billions upon billions to get everyone there. I mean, is the NFL looking at this solely from the perspective of annoying NFL fans? Like, do they just want to like avoid people being burnt out on all of these really annoying ads? And that's the issue? Or is there, you know, a higher minded purpose here?
Well, for a long time, the NFL was actually, and all the sports leagues were really against the broader legalization of sports betting within the United States, right? I mean, this all came to a head when New Jersey was trying to legalize sports betting within its own borders, and it wasn't able to because of prohibition at the federal level. And the Supreme Court in 2018 overturned that. Now, one of the groups that was trying to keep those laws in place that were nominally anti-sports betting were the sports leagues, and their public stance was that they were concerned that sports betting would have some sort of detrimental effect on the integrity of the sport. Now,
the fear being that players would be bribed to throw games, or refs would be bribed to throw games, that sort of thing. It would cause people to wonder if the games were legit.
Well, there's also this kind of seedier aspect of, you know, people at the time thought of sports betting primarily as, you know, you go to Vegas and sit in the sports book with a cigar and an old fashioned, and, you know, and make, you know, ludicrously high stakes bets. And there was this sort of seedier aspect of it, you know, especially when it was illegal in most places. It seems like the cultural attitudes have shifted as things have become more normalized. Like, that kind of, you know, greasy bookie aspect is not really how most people participate in this new sector of the economy. It's mostly online. It's very much mostly through mobile devices, so it's just people have gotten used to it. And when I talk to executives at the media companies and certain sports leagues, their impression was that the normalization and the cultural acceptance has happened a lot faster than they had anticipated. They did not really envision it becoming such a normal part of daily sports fandom as it has become. And I think the fantasy stuff that you're talking about really set the table for that.
Yeah. I mean, this is again, this is kind of how it is interesting to think about how sports gambling was normalized in the United States, because it really was these daily fantasy games where people would set lineups every day. I don't know how deep into the weeds we want to get about daily fantasy and the sort, but like, it's essentially a fantasy game where you set the lineup every day and you're competing against other players. Everybody, you know, pays $10 for an entry, and you know, the winners, the 10% of people who win, split the winnings. But the point is, it is very real, and it's getting to a place where it's not just, you know, setting daily fantasy lineups or betting on who's going to win a game, but like what the first pitch is going to be, if it's going to be a ball or a strike. Like there are all sorts of weird micro bets now that have come to kind of dominate, or have come to be at least a part of the gambling world, which is very interesting.
Yeah, part of the fun of it is the prop bets, right? And that's that kind of like play to play sort of, you know, who's going to, is Tyson Fury going to go down in the fifth round versus the sixth round or whatever. It's that kind of thing. It's like betting almost on plays. It was interesting in talking to some of the folks that are involved in sports betting and the technology of it, and talking about where this could all go. And, you know, if you have live streaming sport game, if you have live streaming games like on your iPad, and you also have the app that is helping you make bets basically in real time, you could see a future where the folks are able to sort of make those like play to play bets in real time during the game. And I mean, that could be just really great for engagement, but really the latency technology just isn't there. Like, you're still in a situation where if you're streaming a game or you're watching on TV, you're probably, you know, 5 to 6, 7 minutes behind the actual action. So it's definitely not there yet. But yeah, I think your point is like the prop bets are getting more and more nuanced and more and more more granular. And that granularity is part of what is interesting to a lot of the fans getting more invested in the game.
Well, and the networks, right? Because, I mean, if you're paying attention, you know, if you're paying super close attention on a play-by-play basis to what is happening on the screen, your focus is there. You know, you are not, or I guess there and on your gambling app, but like your focus is there, and you're not checking out and zoning out, as so often happens with, you know, it's hard to measure, but as one imagined, you know, kind of happens with TV shows or whatever.
Yeah.
Whatever else.
And if you're, you know, if you have an actual stake in the outcome of a game, you are watching games that probably you wouldn't normally, you know, like we're recording on a Thursday. I am 100% sitting down to watch the Dodgers play the Giants tonight in game 5 of the series.
Sure.
Cause you know, hometown team, and that's how most people watch sports. They watch it for their hometown team or their favorite team, where they're emotionally invested. With the rise of sports betting being more common, you have more people that are actually more invested in more games. Or this is how the theory goes.
Right. I mean, and this is also a function of, I mean, again, this is, you can trace the explosion of these NFL packages pretty closely to the rise of fantasy sports just in general, where people are watching more games because they have more players involved in more situations than just the hometown team, than just, you know, the folks they grew up watching and cheering for, which is all very interesting. Let's shift slightly to a different game, the Squid Game.
Yeah,
the Squid Game phenomenon. I'm actually watching it now for another podcast. We're like doing a couple of episodes a week. So by the time we're done with it, somebody will have found a new thing to latch onto, because we're doing it so slowly, but that's okay. but this, it's a legit phenomenon, to the point where even Jeff Bezos is throwing kind of a trolley shout out to the good folks at Netflix, saying, you know, this fan, I, Jeff Bezos, appreciate this anti-capitalist masterpiece, Squid Game.
Yes.
What's going on there, and what is the takeaway that we should have on the internationalization of the kind of streaming television market?
Yeah, well, that's exactly it. I mean, it was just a couple years ago where Bong Joon-ho won Best Picture and Best Director for Parasite, and gave an impassioned speech talking about how really we would basically as an audience, we would have such a richer experience in culture if we could just get over that 1-inch hurdle of reading subtitles, right? It was something to that effect. And this is really proof positive of that exact statement, because you know, this is a show that took forever to get made. Like, the script was being worked on years and years ago, finally came out. It's very high concept. It's incredibly violent. And to your point, anti-capitalist. And this is really just the culmination of a lot of things that Netflix has been doing with Lupin from France, and some shows from Germany, and Money Heist.
Money Heist.
It's just massive. Casa de Papel. So, yeah, and this has really been a strategy of Netflix's to not just throw spaghetti against the wall, but to have a lot of shows from a lot of different parts of the world and just see if it can travel. And in a lot of cases, where we've never really had a lot of experimentation on international movies or shows traveling between, you know, South Korea and U.S. broadcast networks, we're seeing how that plays out, and it seems to be working, at least in this one case. Which,
yeah, I mean, what's interesting about the Netflix strategy is that they've been pursuing this internationalization strategy, I mean, almost since the beginning of the rise of their streaming empire. But what's really interesting is this Squid Game is the first thing that is going to break through in the United States as a massive hit. You know, I want to be very careful how I phrase that, because lots of people watched Lupin, the first season in particular. I think there was a little decay with the second season. Yeah. And Money Heist does okay, but it's not doing like Manifest numbers, right? Manifest is the big huge thing on Netflix that they picked up. But this seems to be the first thing that is really going to travel from overseas to the United States and be that huge crossover hit for them, right?
Yeah, I mean, Money Heist is definitely popular globally. The thing that's unique about this, the thing that's really unique about Squid Game is that it's the first South Korean show to hit number one in the US on Netflix. So that really shows you how it's crossed over. Like, Money Heist and a lot of these shows, yes, big international numbers, pretty big U.S. numbers, I think. Squid Game is just like totally taken off, and a lot of that is due to, I think you could attribute a lot of that to the memes, the TikToks.
Memes.
it's just kind of resonated in a lot of ways. Yeah.
Meme culture. I mean, there's something very striking about the visuals of that show that really lend them to kind of meme status. You know, the costumed antagonists with their kind of PlayStation button faces and you know, bright colors and all that. Yeah. It is interesting. I don't think we have any numbers on this. I'd be curious if you've heard anything, but you mentioned the 1-inch barrier, right? The subtitles at the bottom of the screen. But a lot of people are watching via dubbing. And yes. I'm curious if we have any like good numbers or good sense of what that split is of the subtitled versus dubbing.
I don't know of any numbers, but I know from having talked to people close to it that most people who watch Netflix's international programming that's not in their language do use the dubbing option. So I don't know if it's like 51%, 49% one way, or if it's, you know, 80-20, but my sense is definitely that the majority of people who watch these international programs are watching it dubbed, which is really interesting, because that's not how I do it. I like to be able to hear the language and read the text, but I also completely understand why someone would not want that, want their eyes having to do two different things at the same time.
Well, totally. I mean, this is the cineast's dilemma, right? Yeah. Is that for, you know, the film critic community has always said, you have to watch the subtitles. You got to be able to hear it in the people's voice, and you got to be able to read and look at the, and you got to master the idea of like almost unfocusing a little bit and being able to watch both at the same time, which has always been a barrier for people. Frankly, it's a barrier for me. I mean, I am a film critic, so I have to watch a fair number of foreign films. And when I do so, I always describe subtitles as a necessary evil. Yes, they're necessary, but they're still evil because they do distract from the actual image that the filmmaker has created on the screen.
Yeah. You want to be able to watch them twice almost, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it's interesting to me that the normal people are just like, you know what? We're just gonna watch the dubbed. It's fine. It's, you know, it's, yeah, the mouths don't match up exactly, but it's okay for us.
Yeah. Well, international audiences have done dubbing forever, you know, watching, I think in Italy and some other countries, if you watch a movie, if you're Italian, you're watching a movie starring Tom Cruise, and you hear the dub version, there's an actor whose job it is to be the Tom Cruise of, you know, of Italy. And that's just what he sounds like. So other countries are used to this. We haven't really seen the data. We haven't really seen that experiment in the US as much. You've never had that control group of like, what if you just put this out there and see how people react? So now we do. And it's interesting. The dubbing has also gotten a lot better over the decades. I'm sure you've noticed, you know, it's not like the old kung fu movies where the lips are just nowhere near what the dialogue is doing. Like, they can get it pretty close, and that's through technology and just the talent and the care that they're taking with this kind of
thing. Yeah, I mean, it's a whole art form now, the idea of not just translating the script, you know, verbatim, trying to get exactly the right words, but trying to get the words in a rhythm. It's almost like translating poetry.
Yes.
It is trying to get that rhythm and make the mouths match and all of that, which is very interesting. I also saw, this is only semi-related, but I saw a really interesting short video that an AI company put together that was essentially using their algorithms to like make the mouths of actors match the foreign words that were dubbed in, which is like a whole brave new frontier in filmmaking and technology.
Yeah, it's like the merging of the whole deepfake thing, right? Like,
yeah,
there's some people, it's almost a little creepy sometimes.
I think it is totally creepy, and also like actually a very elegant solution to, as I describe it, the necessary evil of subtitles. I mean, if you can make it work.
Yeah, there are a number of AI companies out there that I've spoken to that are, there are two ways you can do it, right? You can either make the sounds match the lips and do it that way, or you can tweak the imagery. You can use AI to tweak the image to make the lips more closely match the sound. And there's companies that are trying to do it both ways. It's a really interesting new frontier, as you were saying, for this to solve this problem. You know, if someone gets it, it could be pretty interesting, because if you could use technology and speed up the process, you could have more Squid Games theoretically.
Yeah.
You know, if the content's there.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, look, this is going to be another one of these things that there are many anguished ethical debates about in the film critic community. You know, is this truly, you know, what the artist wanted and that sort of thing? But like, at the same time, you know, Netflix is first and foremost a content company. It is only kind of ancillarily an artistic powerhouse. Mm-hmm. If I can put on my cynic hat just for a second, Well, that was everything I wanted to ask you. Is there anything you want to tell people? Do you have any, one more thing? I'm sorry. There was one last thing. Do you have any sense of how things stand with the, IATSE, work stoppage? I know there were some good pieces in the LA Times, but this is not your beat exactly.
Yeah, I think if it gets to a strike level, it's going to be pretty much everyone's beat in this business, at the paper, because we're all going to be, you know, talking to people on the picket lines. Right now, we're talking on a Thursday. IATSE has set the strike date for Monday. So if they don't have a deal basically by Sunday night, you're going to see shows getting productions being canceled, paused, and people going on to picket lines. So that's basically where it is. At this moment, that's obviously, you know, on IATSE's part, that's a negotiation strategy because they want, you know, deadlines have passed, but now they want a deadline for, you know, we're gonna walk off the job if we don't get something done here.
Yeah, it's definitely something to keep an eye on. As you say, it's gonna be everybody's story here if Hollywood shuts down for a month while they have to figure this out. So. Keeping an eye on that. Was there anything else you wanted to tell people? Anything else you think folks should know about that's going on right now?
No, sign up for the Wide Shot if you're sign up for the Wide Shot if you're not already.
Sign up. I'll have there will be a link in the email. Everybody can sign up directly there. It'll be great.
Great. Yeah. Well, this is fun. Good to hash this stuff
all right
out.
thank you so much for being on the show. I really appreciate it, Ryan. Again, sign up for his newsletter, it's fantastic. Keep your eyes out while you're watching the football games this weekend, and just keep track of how many of these sports betting style ads that you see. I'm curious to hear what other people are getting on their screens at home. Anyway, I'm Sonny Bunch. This has been The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. Very, very glad you guys listened. And we'll be back next week with another episode.
If you love to travel, Capital One has a rewards credit card that's perfect for you. With the Capital One Venture X card, you earn unlimited double miles on everything you buy. Plus, you get premium benefits at a collection of luxury hotels when you book on Capital One Travel. And with Venture X, you get access to over 1,000 airport lounges worldwide. Open up a world of travel possibilities with a Capital One Venture X card. What's in your wallet?
Terms apply. Lounge access is subject to change. See CapitalOne.com for details.